Hi, hello, and welcome to the Utah Puck Report. Jay Stevens here. Kind of cool co-host today is my son, Tegan Stevens, is helping out. He's brought one of his former professors, Dr. Leslie Podlog, goes by Les. You're in sports psychology, you've done kinesiology, and you're here today to kind of help us get from injury to back to performance. But first, let me let you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your history.
Yeah, well, so great to be with you, Jay and Tegan, and yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast. So I'm originally from Canada, and certainly as a Canadian, I know your focus is on hockey and hockey-related issues, so it's definitely something that was part of my youth growing up in Calgary, Alberta. And I got into the sport of amateur wrestling, I guess, when I was younger. My brother got into it, and then I followed his lead. And it's a very physical sport, very technical sport. That is the amateur wrestling. And unfortunately, by the time I went to university and I studied at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, and I seemed to have one serious injury after another. So I tore my anterior cruciate ligament 3 times, and I had a dislocated shoulder and dislocated elbow. So I guess it was these experiences that led to my academic interest in kind of better understanding not just the obvious physical challenges associated with injury, but the psychological demands that it places on athletes. And so I was fortunate to pursue my graduate studies. I did a master's in sociology at Simon Fraser, and then I went on to pursue my PhD at the University of Western Australia in Perth, Australia. And there I focused on the psychological challenges that athletes face after a serious injury, and then just trying to develop some strategies to help them recover and return to play, which for many is their preeminent goal. And so for the better part of the last 20 years or so, much of the research that I've done has been dedicated to that topic. And I've moved around a little bit. I did my studies, as I mentioned, in Australia, and then for several years I worked in a small town called Bathurst at Charles Sturt University, and taught sport and exercise psychology classes, and kind of continued my research looking at adolescent experiences with injury, and then also sort of parents and how they try to support athletes. And I've since moved around. I was at Texas Tech University, then at University of Utah, and I just recently took a position as a professor here at the University of Montreal.
Yeah, so now you're right in the heart of hockey. Montreal doesn't get, I mean, that's, it doesn't get much more serious than that. That's a hard place to play too, yeah.
Yeah, well, definitely. As I was mentioning before we started recording, it was fun to recently get out to a Canadians, Montreal Canadiens hockey game, and definitely the Quebecers take hockey seriously, and it's a sport that a lot of youth participate in, and it's also one, of course, where injuries, both musculoskeletal injury and concussion, are common and I suppose increasingly in the news, or you know, there's greater concern about the effects of injury and head trauma, for instance. And so, yeah, it's always certainly a key challenge, I suppose, in the career of any athlete. And always something that's pervasive, but something that most athletes contend with at some point during their hockey career. So,
yeah. So for me in particular, And I know as a goalie, you know, our injuries are always a little bit different than the forwards. But I can remember a time I took a shot to the throat, and, you know, that obviously had some trauma with it. I spent the night in the hospital. I think I spent the next day in the hospital. They were really worried about swelling. So, and then the next day I'm back on the ice, and there wasn't a lot of, oh, okay, you're hurt, you're recovered now, get back at it. But I think for every athlete, whatever the injury is, if it happens during play, that's got to be inside your mind. And I know at least for the next, it wasn't just a couple of days, like at least for the next month that I got on the ice, I was thinking about that slap shot that hit me in the throat and how bad that hurt. And, you know, you have that psychological puck shyness or whatever we call it, but there's a block there. So even if it happens to your knee or if it happens to whatever the injury, immediately everybody thinks, okay, we got to get him healed. We got to get the bone fixed. We got to get the muscle back together. But nobody really talks about that psychological part. And it's hard to go from where you were as an athlete before that injury to recovering and then being back there psychologically. So yeah. Do you have guidelines? Like how do we start addressing this?
Yeah. Well, so it's a great point. I think often or traditionally when you're trying to get athletes back into their kind of training environment or competitive play, there's a primary focus definitely on the physical aspects of the injury and kind of the biological healing. But more and more, there's lots of evidence to suggest that just exactly what you said, that, you know, just because an athlete may be physically ready doesn't mean they're mentally prepared. And sometimes there's maybe a lot of pressures that the individual internalizes, or especially in a sport like hockey, you know, where there's a culture of being tough and kind of working through pain and injury, that the athlete may say they're ready, even if they may not actually feel mentally prepared to do so. So I think, you know, there's a number of important steps. Like certainly one key thing is just legitimizing and kind of normalizing, if you will, the fact that it's perfectly understandable to have concerns, apprehensions, worries about competing. And in your example, you know, if you take a puck when, you know, someone's shooting a hard disc at you at 70, 80, 90 miles an hour, it makes sense that you would not want to have that experience again, particularly if you incurred, you know, a serious injury that may kept you out for a period of time. So just, I think, first of all, kind of helping athletes to realize that it's, perfectly legitimate and normal to have those apprehensions. Often in sports psychology, there's different strategies or techniques that we use to help people deal with fear or injury, or fear of re-injury, for instance. So one technique that's commonly used is just imagery or visualization, which is often used for different purposes. So it could be to help the athlete perform well, but it could also be to help them imagine themselves sort of gradually working through certain fears. And the idea there is, rather than trying to avoid that which you're concerned about, you have to sort of actively confront it, right? If you're always trying to avoid something that you're apprehensive about, then the fear just stays there. It's only by kind of actively working through it that you begin to develop a certain confidence in your ability to surmount the problem. So, you know, we can do that gradually. You might have the athlete maybe just kind of imagine themselves sort of incrementally or gradually working their way up so that they're doing progressively more difficult skills. So maybe they're just, first of all, just imagining themselves going to the rink and putting on their equipment, or, you know, like stepping onto the ice, because maybe that situation generates anxiety or fear or worry. So, you know, you kind of start slow and then maybe build to the point where the individual feels less fear or worry or apprehension. The other thing that we often try to do in sports psychology is just to have athletes think about how they interpret fear or worry. So often we think of fear or worry as like a negative thing, something to be avoided. But in reality, you know, you probably, you know, irrespective of injury, when you get into different performance situations, again, it's going to be pretty normal that you're going to have some arousal or anxiety or, but for the best athletes, they realize that that's typically what they need in order to perform well. So some of it has to do with the interpretation of your anxiety or your your fear as something that you can actually use to your advantage, right? So maybe it's you think, well, I'm going to, you know, because I'm a little bit concerned about getting hurt again, then I need to make sure I take preventative measures to avoid certain things. Or I have to realize that when I get into specific situations, I just have to be mindful of, you know, I'm not necessarily going to put my head sort of down when I get close to the boards because I don't want to hurt my neck, for instance. Or so kind of using the fear or anxiety as not something to be interpreted negatively, but more as an indication that, okay, well, I just need to make sure I take injury prevention measures. So, you know, those are just, I guess, a few examples of the kinds of maybe specific strategies that could be used to kind of help the athlete work through fears or concerns. In general, I would say when you're working with the athlete who's returning, there's three main kinds of issues that tend to be important to address. One is to help the athlete develop their sense of competence. So for many injured athletes, they lose the sense that they're capable or proficient or that they will be able to perform as they once did. And so, you know, whether it's, again, maybe using imagery or setting specific goals, you know, maybe it's they're having kind of irrational thoughts. It's like, well, you know, I'm the only one who this has happened to, or it's worse for me, or, you know, maybe they're sort of taking one example of an athlete who didn't return, whereas they could find numerous examples of athletes who do return, but they're choosing to look at sort of, you know, they're pulling the one negative example and not looking at other examples that they could be looking at. So one thing is you want to employ different strategies to help develop their sense of competence. The other kind of issue that is common for returning athletes is they lose a sense of autonomy or a sense of control. And so they may feel like they don't control their body or the timing of their circumstances. And so things like giving them choices in terms of their, which, you know, exercises they might want to do can make them feel like they have ownership over what they're involved in with their recovery, or giving them a rationale, like here's why you want to do this, or why this may be beneficial for you, or even just sort of taking their perspective, because it's often easy for coaches, for instance, to say, oh, well, you know, like you've got to do this, or to make them feel controlled or coerced. And so, you know, sometimes just taking the athlete's perspective can make them feel like they have a voice, that they have a say, that they have some control over their circumstance. And then the third thing is for rehabbing, and often athletes who are returning, they don't feel connected to their sport, or, you know, they may lose sort of their identity as an athlete. So just developing or integrating opportunities to them for them to feel connected to their sport or other athletes. So those are some principles, I guess, and concerns we try and address to help augment the sort of return to sport after injury.
Now, those are a couple of things I never even thought about there. T, do you have a question?
Yeah. So I know self-determination theory, which you just kind of covered, was a big thing in our class. I had a question related to relatedness. Like, what advice do you have for not only coaches, but teammates for helping their teammate get back from an injury? Like, what can they do to help speed up the process, make them still feel like part of the team?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. You know, I think sometimes teammates can be well-intentioned and they, you know, may ask, okay, well, like, when are you coming back? Or, you know, sometimes that can be a bit of a double-edged sword. They may, on the one hand, it's great, I think, when teammates just reach out and show an interest, or, you know, let the injured athlete know that they want the athlete to come back. But sometimes the injured athlete can also interpret that as pressure. And so, you know, just I guess from a teammate standpoint, being clear that, you know, they're thinking of you, and if the athlete kind of wants to talk, or, you know, that's they're there for that, but also when they say that they want them back, that, you know, just being explicit that they're not trying to pressure someone, because that can also sort of make the athlete feel a little bit more controlled, that they're not, as I mentioned, autonomous in their return. And also whether it's teammates or coaches, significant others can maybe identify or sit down with the athlete and say, you know, are there different ways in which you might contribute to staying involved or helping the team, even though you're not competing? So maybe it's finding other sort of roles, or maybe it's like helping the coach analyze the video of the game, or maybe it's just sort of using the player's skills and knowledge to benefit the team to stay involved in a way that doesn't necessarily involve the physical training to the same extent. Or whether it's the teammates again or coach, maybe there's some opportunities, certainly as the athlete's getting more and more active, to integrate their rehab into some of the training. So maybe if they're doing like dry land training, then maybe there's times where the athlete can do some of their rehab, for instance, alongside their teammates who are doing training, so that they don't feel too isolated or alienated.
Yeah, oh. That's something I never thought about, is that you're getting pressure, or you're putting pressure on somebody by asking them if they're all right or when they're coming back. I know, and that happens in the fire service all the time too, outside of sports, is that we have a firefighter get injured, and then we're immediately like, you know, they go to light duty. So you'll see them bringing the mail around or coming and, you know, bringing equipment out from our headquarters. And every guy's like, hey, when you coming back? When you coming back? When you coming back? You never think about the external pressure you're putting on them to either heal too quickly, or, you know, just that belonging cue that you're throwing out there. You're changing their position. I didn't think about that. Do you have another question?
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, again, maybe those comments are well-intentioned, and the athlete may, or, you know, the performer, the firefighter, as you indicated, Jay, may feel on the one hand, it's nice because maybe it's a reminder that they're wanted. But again, those comments can also be interpreted as, you know, pressure or indication that they need to get back. And sometimes, especially, you know, on the mindset of wanting to get back sooner rather than later, on the one hand, is good if it motivates the athlete. But on the other hand, if it pushes the athlete to get back prematurely, then clearly that may not be so good, because obviously no one wants to get to return only to get re-injured or to perform poorly or to, you know, not really ultimately be ready to actually return, but to do so anyway. So, I think it's just thinking carefully and explicitly about the communication. So again, the coach or the athlete may say, okay, well, hey, we want you back, but, you know, when I say, or when I ask you, you know, when do you think you'll be back? I'm not doing that to pressure you. I'm just to be explicit in their communication. I only ask because, you know, we think you're a great teammate and are happy when you're back, and those kinds of things. Right. So just thinking about how the comment could be interpreted isn't always done, but is something that can be useful to consider.
I noticed along these lines, you have some research into how either extrinsic or intrinsic motivation plays a role in recovering from injury too. Do you want to like briefly talk about what those motivation types are and how they play a role on recovering from injury?
Yeah, a great question, Tegan. So intrinsic motivation, I guess, refers to broadly when people do or engage in a task for the inherent enjoyment or interest of the task. So they're you know, playing hockey because, you know, they love the feeling of skating on the ice, or, you know, there's just the movement or of playing the game, or You know, they enjoy relationships on their team and the camaraderie or the bonding. Or so there's features of the game in and of itself that are inherently rewarding. And that's the only reason you need to get them or to incentivize them, if you will, to do it, is the game in and of itself is the incentive. Whereas extrinsic motivation, by contrast, refers more to engaging in a behavior or an endeavor when one is induced by forces external to or outside of the activity itself. So the only reason I'm really playing hockey is because of the post-game beers, right? And I like to sit and have a drink afterwards. And if you take that away, then I really have sort of no main reason for doing this. Or it could be other things like, you know, I'm doing it for the trophy, or I'm a professional player and maybe I'm at the end of my career. And again, per injury topic, maybe you've had lots of injuries, but you feel like, you know, I don't enjoy the game quite as much as I used to, but I'm getting paid and I have another year or two left in my contract, and I need this money to secure my family future. So those sort of reasons are external to the game itself. But I suppose the point is certainly both can be powerful drivers of behavior. So if you ask hockey players or athletes in general, why are you participating in sport? There may be a mix of different reasons as to why, but the question becomes to what are the implications, if any, of when people do things for more intrinsic, more internal reasons like interest, enjoyment, satisfaction from the activity itself versus those more external rewards, or it could also be like punishments. Like I'm doing this because if I don't, then I'll feel bad or guilty for not doing it. Or, you know, at a younger level, maybe you think, well, my parents said, if I don't compete in hockey, then they're going to take something I enjoy away from me, right? Or they'll be annoyed at me. So again, both the internal or intrinsic forms of motivation and the extrinsic can be powerful motivators or induce action. But I guess what we found in at least two studies that I conducted, one was with, we had about 200 some odd athletes from different countries, including some were hockey players, but athletes across different sports. These were fairly elite level competitors participating in like semi-professional or professional or sort of varsity level sport. And we kind of asked them, okay, well, think about the most recent injury that you've had. And we asked them about sort of these different kinds of motivation to return. So our question was, well, why did you return? What sort of drove you to or energized you to come back? And then we also asked them about how they felt or perceived their performance to be once they returned. And so what we found was that the athletes who were more intrinsically motivated seemed to have more positive outcomes once they returned to sport versus those who were more extrinsically motivated. So, for instance, the athletes who were higher in intrinsic motivation reported higher levels of desire to continue playing the sport, or they perceived that their performances were better after their injury, or just as good or better after their injury as they were before, or they perceived that they had less performance anxiety than athletes who are more extrinsically motivated. On the other hand, the athletes who reported higher levels of extrinsic motivation indicated that they were more likely to be worried about things like getting hurt again, or that they had higher levels of performance anxiety than those who were more intrinsically motivated. So in the one study that I'm referring to, we didn't necessarily ask them, well, why was that the case? because we just gave them these surveys and we saw that there were these relationships between the different kinds of motivation driving them to the return and their self-report of how they were performing after they returned to sport. But I guess what it shows is provide some preliminary evidence that in the case of an injured performer, the reason why you may be coming back may have implications for how at least you perceive you're performing once you actually do return. And so, you know, there may be, in this case, some benefits to being more intrinsically motivated. And so then our task as researchers is to sort of speculate and think, well, why might there be these relationships between more intrinsic motivation and more positive return to sport outcomes, so to speak. And at least you mentioned this sort of theory. In psychology, we like to use a lot of theories because they help us understand why a certain phenomenon may exist. So according to this one theory, it's called self-determination theory. The idea is when we're more intrinsically motivated, there's beneficial implications because when we do things for the inherent enjoyment or interest of the activity, it satisfies these three basic psychological or mental needs that all human beings have. And I actually touched upon them earlier, and that's to be competent, to be capable at what we do. In other words, we tend to like to do things we're good at or feel proficient at. We tend to, as human beings, want to have some sense of control rather than feeling like other people are kind of pulling our strings, like a puppeteer master, right, who's kind of controlling our actions. We sort of have this need to feel a sense that what we do is under our influence or subject to our influence. And as human beings, we have a need to connect with others or to be related to other human beings. And so the idea, at least from this explanation, is there may be benefits to doing things for intrinsic motivations because fundamentally, when we do things for enjoyment, inherent interest, that it's more likely to satisfy those basic psychological needs. And so, there may be some reasons why people, you know, you would want to promote the injured athlete to be intrinsically motivated. And so, you know, from a practical standpoint, then it's sort of like, okay, well, if we want to promote intrinsic motivation, that theory is also very practical because it suggests, well, if I want to promote intrinsic motivation because there's some evidence to show it's helpful in terms of how athletes perform, then you can say, okay, well, what are some ways in which we can help the injured athlete feel competent? What are some ways in which we can help them feel autonomous or control and to feel connected? And when we do that, we're more likely to increase the chance that they'll be intrinsically motivated.
Interesting. I've never really thought about it like that, but you see, especially as a parent and as a coach, you see players that seem to just get out there and love the game, and you see kids that are out there that you can tell are maybe just playing because their parents played or whatever. They didn't know another path. I didn't think about that helping with healing. I guess it makes sense, but does that also, I know you've done some research on burnout. Is that same cues there, like intrinsic versus extrinsic? Or?
Yeah, well, definitely there, you know, in some studies with some colleagues from Sweden, we've found that, numerous researchers have found that burnout very much can be a motivational issue. Burnout is characterized by a number of different characteristics. So one is that you tend to start to devalue something that you once enjoyed, right? So I start out enjoying an activity and then I become, you know, I feel more cynical about the activity or negative in how I think about it. Another is, so that's the first component, is that you sort of devalue. Another is that you feel like you're no longer experiencing success in your, the activity. And then a third is that you're emotionally and physically exhausted. And so that exhaustion seems to be a key kind of component, both physical and mental. And there's some studies definitely showing that if you follow athletes, say, over the course of their season, and you look at the beginning, if you ask them about their motivation, that they tend to, at the start of the season, be more intrinsically motivated. So they'll say things like, yeah, like, I'm playing because I, you know, enjoy, again, like, you know, I just love running down the field, or, you know, I like the feeling of passing the ball or of making a good play, or, you know, just like features of the game in and of itself that are satisfying. And then, and if you ask them sort of what their burnout levels are, they tend to be low at the start of the season, which makes sense. And then if you sort of follow them over time, as their burnout levels tend to increase, so too does their levels of extrinsic motivation, that they start to focus more on playing the game because, well, I'm tired and I'm fatigued, but I don't want to let other people down. Or I feel like there's more and more pressure towards the end of the season now to play well and win the cup or the trophy, or to, you know, so these external reasons seem to be more salient, and the higher the level of extrinsic motivation, that also seems to be related to burnout. So just to clarify, when I say related, that doesn't mean it's causing burnout. It just means that there's, as one increases, so too does the likelihood of others, you know, in this case, burnout. But, you know, most sort of phenomenon, whether it's burnout or the effectiveness of one's return to play after injury, there's usually multiple factors at play that are responsible for any particular outcome or behavior or state of affairs. But definitely motivation seems to be linked to burnout. Yeah. So
that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
Kind of wrapping up, I know you're on a time constraint here. Just like things, like takeaway points you want people to know about recovering from injury, and then maybe like on the mental side, kind of admitting you need help, like how we can destigmatize mental health, kind of.
Yeah. So I guess to your first question, you know, I suppose we've kind of talked a little bit about just being sort of disentangling this idea that just because you're physically ready doesn't necessarily mean you're psychologically prepared. And I think, you know, whether it's the coach or the parent or a sport medicine provider, even just having some discussions with the athletes about what are their hesitations, you know, sort of, again, legitimizing the fact that it's perfectly okay to have some concerns as they re-enter kind of a competitive arena or say transition to higher levels of activity, I think is important and useful. You know, we kind of talked about those sort of three concepts again of the competence being important. So just thinking about ways, well, what if anything can I as a coach, teammate, friend do to help the athlete feel capable under what's often a challenging and frustrating time for the athlete? You know, are there ways to give them sort of a sense of control? And I mentioned a few examples by like taking the athlete's perspective, giving them some rationales, or giving them options and choices. Because if you choose to do something, then you're more likely to feel sort of volitional or a sense of control. And then just, you know, making efforts to reach out. Maybe it's just a text or a call saying, hey, just letting you know I was thinking about you and hope you're doing okay. Something as simple as that can sometimes go a long way. Or, you know, hey, if you feel like you want to come out and do some exercises with the team, or how about we sit down and just meet and, you know, see where things are at and how you're progressing. Those small little acts can sometimes make a big difference in sort of meeting that need for connection. And then I guess, you know, I think more and more in terms of your point about destigmatizing, you know, the challenges or kind of like mental illness, certainly in the case of injury recovery, I think, you know, if I'm speaking with an athlete or, you know, the idea, if you ask questions like, well, to what extent do you think is like motivation or concentration or confidence are important in your sport performance? Most of the time athletes will, or coaches will say, yeah, sure, that's important. And if you ask them, well, you know, do you spend time training your sort of physical components of the game? And they're like, well, of course I would. So, you know, then if you can kind of get into some questions about, well, doesn't it also make sense to then sort of train the mental component? And that doesn't mean you're a head case just because you want to optimize your motivation or your confidence or your ability to concentrate. That, you know, I think most athletes and coaches realize today, especially the mental part of the game is important, whether it's the game of performing or the game of rehab. And, you know, just, I guess, to try to put things in sometimes into sort of a performance language can help, right? Just as you would train these physical skills, so too training these psychological skills is important and can be helpful in order to optimize your experience, to maximize your performance, to, you know, increase your well-being. Again, I think there's also sort of these larger cultural shifts that are taking place. You know, documentaries. There was one, I think, that Michael Phelps, for instance, did particular on like mental health and, you know, efforts by different high performance athletes to kind of suggest that, hey, they're human beings and subject to all the kinds of challenges that any other people face, perhaps more so given the sort of pressures that they face and the fact that they get a lot of attention, sometimes not always so positive. Yeah,
that's good. It's crazy because we've just had a lot of that same stuff come up with one of our athletes that was, he's been on the show a few times, and he went through a lot of stuff and he rehabbed the physical stuff, but he also had lost his father while all this stuff was going on. And he never rehabbed the mental part. And he is now admitting 2 years later that I should have gotten help. And I think it cost me my shot at playing pro or playing in the NHL. He's still playing pro. And we also, one of our frequent co-hosts is Jordan Parisi. He's a goalie that played at North Dakota, and then he was in the New Jersey Devils and Pittsburgh Penguins system. His brother is a superstar. And he talked about his best performances came when he was taking an hour before the game, mentally processing, going through what he thought he might face during that game. And he said, you know, a lot of it was imaging and going through that. But some of it was just taking time to, you know, check in with myself. You know, there was the going through each part of the game, but there was also just being like, hey, here I am. This is time to take a breath, time to mentally check in before this game. And I think a lot of athletes just don't even think about it. They just get there and they're like, I got to stretch my hamstrings, or, you know, my back's a little tight, got to see the therapist, but they never think, yeah, I need to take a second and just mentally check where I'm at and be prepared.
So, yeah, no, those are great points. And, you know, certainly to your earlier point, Jay, I mean, again, whether it's injury or any other sort of phase that an athlete may be going through, life is happening all around them, right? And, you know, whether it's relationships, friendships, school, work, people are, of course, aren't just robots, and life events and experiences can have, of course, this profound and severe impact, positively, negatively, and so, you know, there's actually like a scale that measures life events occurrences and life event stress. And those could be positive things. Maybe you get a new job that you worked long and hard to get, but then also that new job may entail a whole bunch of other sort of stressors because you're in a new environment or you're interacting with new people or whatever it might be. And so, you know, whatever's happening in one's life also can certainly come to bear on their recovery, on their sport performance. So realizing that, and also I agree completely, just, you know, sort of taking some time just to maybe not only sort of image or visualize what may happen in the game, but also just taking a moment to say, okay, well, like scanning yourself, sort of what's happening, how am I feeling kind of coming into this practice or this game, just maybe taking a moment to take stock of where you're at and maybe what you need to do just to get into the right frame of mind to perform well. Doesn't always happen, but as you suggested, may have lots of benefit.
Doc, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. I think this is honestly for me and where I'm at in my life as a, like as a coach and as a parent more than as a player. I mean, it took me a long time to accept, like I can evaluate my own performance now and know what I need to fix as a beer league goalie, you know, and I know if it's not my fault, but as a parent, as a coach and seeing the pressure that's being put on the kids or the pressure that I put on my own son to perform, I'm just in a different place where I could talk about this for hours and just absorb everything you're saying. And I hope our audience is taking the same thing. And I know your time is precious. So I can't thank you enough for coming out and talking to us about it and get the ball rolling on and getting the mental health and getting these injured players back to feeling like they belong and that they could perform and the importance of that. So Tigger,
yeah. I just want to thank you again for coming out. I know injury is a sensitive topic, and I hope the people listening will take the advice they're getting. It's not just the physical stuff, it's the mental stuff. And I hope the coaches and teammates listen as well and learn how, like, it's not just healing, is not individual, it's like group effort.
Yeah, no, it's great to have the discussion with you both. And that's a great comment, Tegan. Certainly, you know, the success of any one individual isn't just a product of that one person's effort, but there's often a lot of support and sort of group work that goes into helping the athlete achieve their performance level. And I guess one kind of final thought or comment is, you know, I think some of the skills that I talked about earlier, whether it's, you know, imagery or whatever, using any of these strategies that I've mentioned, goal setting or, you know, how one's thinking about the situation are always to some extent a work in progress. It's not like, you know, again, just in the language of physical skills, it's not like one ever fully or finally completely masters a skill forever and all time. Right? It's always a little bit of a work in progress. And I think the same applies to these mental or psychological skills, as we refer to them in the world of sports psychology, is that you're always sort of working to refine, improve, and that's kind of part of the process. So, it's great to be with you. And yeah, thanks for the chance to chat and reflect.
Thanks for your time. Good luck on going to those Montreal games. It's fun that I think the Cup's going to make a return to Canada, but it's going to be your native Calgary. we have a Utah player playing for Calgary this year, so we're all fans.
Yeah. I feel a little torn now. And my son was asking me whether the Flames will be playing the Canadiens. And I'm like, oh, at some point they will. That'll be a fun and interesting game to watch, I'm sure. So thanks, guys.
Well, Doc, thanks again. And we're just going to close out right there. That'll be the Utah Puck Report.